And what really helped me in those situations is thinking that it's always better to do good inconsistently than to consistently do the bad thing. What it does for me is I think that many of us try to do good and we avoid harming others with our actions, but you cannot do everything right. You're always leaving a mark, and then the thought of accepting some of these inconsistencies helps me, not as an excuse, but helps to relax a bit. We're so fast in condemning people sometimes, and it would really help us to be a bit less judgmental towards others, but also to ourselves.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Purple Stars podcast. I am Sarah, your host, and we're so honored to have our guest on the show today. He has been doing so much good in the animal welfare sector. He's the HSI Executive Director of Europe, and we have the privilege that he is here today sharing his time, his insight, and heartfelt stories with us. Please welcome Ruud Tombroek.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. It's great to be here, and thank you for producing this wonderful podcast. I really enjoy listening.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, we are always excited having someone, especially from HSI, on the show. As you know, we had your wonderful colleague Martina last year on the show, and people absolutely loved the episodes. So I was very excited to hear that you're also happy to share your time with us. Ruud, I went through your bio and I was just blown away with everything you have achieved and done in your life. Could you share a little bit about your journey with our audience? And I'm especially curious because I read, first you were working in various leadership positions at the Netherlands Red Cross, American Red Cross, amongst others. And then you transitioned to the animal welfare sector. Like, what inspired you to do it? And like, how did everything unfold?
Right. So for me, actually, Sarah, it's not very much of a big deal. You're calling it a transition. For me, it was, it didn't feel like that. So I guess that for me, the red thread throughout my working life has been a focus on alleviating, preventing, ending suffering. So personally, I have some kind of a connection with other individuals who are struggling, are in pain, are suffering, others who need help. And I think that I'm in the lucky position that I can offer some help. And I never made that distinction between humans and non-human animals. So for me, it did not feel like a big step.
I love that. And what inspired you to go down that route? Is someone in your family, or did you just always, because, you know, it's one thing having a big heart for helping others, as a lot of us do, but taking actually a career in that sector, I think, is a whole other thing.
Yeah, so I can tell you that I started actually in the commercial sector. I worked at Philips Electronics in a marketing department, and then I felt that something was missing. I started to do volunteer work in the evenings, and at the Red Cross, by the way, and some other charities in the Netherlands. And at some point I thought, okay, but I like the work that I do, the contents of the work. I like the marketing, etc., and the techniques. But it feels like a little bit, empty sometimes. Maybe that's not the right word, but a little bit like, who am I doing it for? And what am I doing it for? And then in the evenings, at the Red Cross, doing work as a volunteer, I started to really get excited and inspired. And then I thought, well, maybe I can combine the two and find a job at the Red Cross, which I did. And I stayed there for a long time.
I'm very happy you brought up, you mentioned you felt something was missing. Mm-hmm. And how you described how you felt when you were volunteering. I call it feeling alive. Mm. And I've had many guests on our show. We talked about how do we find the purpose in our life? And, you know, the meaning that makes us feel alive and makes us have that fire and not wait till, you know, like the weekend is coming and Christmas is coming and the vacation is coming. So what gave you the courage to follow that heart tug? Because a lot of people have that and also know that something is missing in their life, but they're too scared to try and to explore and rather stay in their comfort zone and the known instead of taking that leap of faith.
Right. So what made it easier for me, Sarah, is that this happened in the beginning of my working career. So I was still finding my way. I had worked in the commercial sector for, I think, 3-4 years or so. So there was not like a long career path which sometimes squeezes you in a certain direction, and then sometimes it feels hard to get out of that. So for me, helped was that it happened early. That insight of, okay, now I need to start to combine the work that I love to do in marketing and communications and with an organization that I really love and that I want to work for, so I can do something good. But I'm not sure if it's always needed to find that in your work. So okay. There are, I know many people who do their job. Yes, and they like to work with their colleagues. They like the job, and then do other things in their free time that really, really inspire them. And for them, that can be a very healthy balance as well. So I think it's very, very individually, that it's a very individual thing.
It's a very great point. Because I think a lot of people can't find their purpose, or actually they have found their purpose, but they struggle with it because everyone, or nowadays in society, people have this label. If it's your purpose, it's your work. And I always tell a lot of people, especially young people that I talk to, you know, when like just getting right out of college, I'm like, guys, just make sure it is your life. Do something where you feel alive, but also know there are a lot of people that have a job that they are content with, but what really sets their soul and heart on fire, they might do on the weekend. You know how it is with a lot of artists, for example, you know, like maybe at some point they don't earn money with it yet, or they love dogs and they want to do dog walking on the weekend. So whatever it is, I just think it's important to know, do in any area of your life, both the professional and the personal, something that makes you content, and also have at least one thing that really sets your soul on fire.
I think the key in what you just said is the word content. So if you have that feeling, if you do something in your life, if you feel that you have a well-balanced portfolio of activities that you do throughout the week, then you will have that feeling.
Ruud, I'm also wondering, you've been now over 25 years transforming operations in welfare and also humanitarian nonprofits.
Mm, yep.
What have been some both internal and external challenges that you had to face, and what helped you to move forward despite all these challenges? I'm aware it's a very loaded question. We could do just one episode on that. But yeah, because I know a lot of people have this picture that when you love something, it's, you know, you're always excited. Things mainly fall into place. And I like to share, and I've shared this in a few episodes, we have a German word for passion, and it's called Leidenschaft. And this includes the word suffering.
Right.
And I think, as much as I love the English language, but that's one word that I just think is brilliant because it really describes the reality of a path. Because on TV and on social media and in media, we only see the wins, you know, the gold medals, the overnight success, but we don't see all the nights that they were up doubting themselves, like hustling, not knowing how to pay the rent next month, and all these things. So what's your take on that?
So what exactly is your question?
What were some challenges that you had, maybe even fears or doubts or challenges you had to face on the outside?
And how I managed to overcome these. Right. Yeah, so I think that resistance is something that that we all experience, and sometimes I feel that we somehow must to become effective in the things that you do, you need to now and then get out of your comfort zone, because if you always stay in your comfort zone, then you will never learn, never experience new things. It will always be pleasant and okay, but not much more than that. And getting out of your comfort zone so now and then and do something that maybe feels a bit scary or strange or whatever, is I think very, very healthy for people in general, because you will learn, and you will also learn about the things that that do not feel right, that do not fit with you and who you are. So and when while you were talking, there was something else that came to mind. And it's a thought that really has helped me in some situations. It's just one line. And let me provide a little bit of context here. I've been a vegetarian for over 20 years, and the number of times that in those years I had to defend myself at dinners, at parties. Don't get me wrong, I sort of get that people like me to explain. So especially when eating vegetarian is not the norm. But then some people who are not a vegetarian, are not vegan, some of these people eat meat every day, they sometimes started to challenge my choices and criticize my inconsistencies. So they saw the leather strap of my watch. I was in those years I was still wearing watches, and then they said, well, Ruud, that is not very consistent, is it? You eat vegetarian, but you wear something made of leather, and that's sometimes a bit in a condescending way. Now, I'm pretty sure that some of your listeners will recognize that. And what really helped me in those situations is thinking that it's always better to do good inconsistently than to consistently do the bad thing. What it does for me is I think that many of us try to do good, and we avoid harming others with our actions. But you cannot do everything right. You're always leaving a mark. And then the thought of accepting some of these inconsistencies helps me, not as an excuse, but helps to relax a bit. We're so fast in condemning people sometimes, and it would really help us to all be a bit less judgmental towards others, but also to ourselves. So these are a couple of things that I that really help me. Better to do good things inconsistently than to consistently do the bad thing. That is what I've been telling other people who started to judge.
I want to repeat that because this is so good. It's better to do the good inconsistently than doing the bad consistently. And it's so good. It's so good because I think it's also something that can be applied to any area in our life, whether it's, you know, like the positive thoughts we have, the routines we have, how much we do for others, for ourselves, and just knowing it's not black and white and it's not 100% or zero. And because we are not machines, we're humans. And that's why there, you know, like consistency looks different for everyone, and also inconsistency. And I personally think you're probably doing good consistently. It's just a definition of consistently, you know? And
Well, I think that I'm not, Sarah. I'm okay. Not always. So when I walk on the street, there may be little animals on the street that I step on and maybe kill. So that's what I mean by it's impossible to not leave a mark. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. So maybe we should be a little bit less judgmental sometimes towards each other, but also to ourselves, because we're also, many of us, we want to do good, and then we say, it's not good enough. It's still not good enough. It's still not good enough. And we work harder and harder and harder and harder. And then comes the time when we sit at home with a burnout, and mm-hmm. nobody wants that, and no one benefits from that. So maybe a little bit relax a bit to now and then.
It's such a great reminder, also for myself, because sometimes, so I do consciously make effort to rest and to meditate and just to, you know, spend quality time outside my work. But as we talked before our interview, when our work is so deeply ingrained in our hearts, it's sometimes hard, or harder, maybe a better way to put it, harder to take a step back and to say, okay, it's the weekend, I'm taking vacation. Mm. And especially in your world, as you mentioned, you know, like you see all the cruelty happening. Mm. And how do you manage to take a time off when, whilst you know everything that's happening out there?
Mm. Yeah. I guess it's that same thought. It's about realizing, knowing that that there is only so much that you can do, and I know that I do my best. I do what I can. But I do not have the illusion that I am going to change the whole world. So there is only so much, and sometimes that can be small and it can be baby steps that you can do. But you need to. I think it's very important that you are able to accept that. And on the other point that you raised on also. The work that I do is so I see so many videos. I read reports about what is happening to animals and animal suffering, and I can tell you that it's still after these years, it it still breaks my heart every time when I see something like that and when I see those videos, and I get tears in my eyes. But that is, you know, it's part of what I do. It also gives me energy, not at that moment, but after that, it gives me the energy to get going again and to have that fight. So I really hope that for me, the moment never comes to where I start looking away and say, no, I'm going to close myself for that. I'm not going to watch the news anymore. I'm not going to, because it's always about bad things happening and wars and suffering. I'm not going to do that anymore. I hope that moment never comes, because that would be leading to inaction. And I also need that emotion, although it's painful sometimes, to do what I do and to keep on going.
Not to come to the point where we then close ourselves up to what we used to love. It's maybe also a great thought and a great motivation for us to rest when we do rest, to also say, not just besides the fact saying we're human, you know, like we need our rest. It's as important as the work, but also saying it's part of honoring my purpose and honoring my path that I am also resting, because that allows me to walk that path for as long as I'm here.
Exactly. Pause, rest, meditate, what you're doing. I know a lot of people, I'm not doing it myself. I know a lot of people who every day they take 20 minutes to at the end of the day to sit down, relax, meditate. I think those moments can be really, really helpful in keeping sane in a sometimes a bit of an insane world, Sarah.
Oh my God, it's so true. Yeah, sometimes I'm also like, oh God, this insanity. I just got to take a few deep breaths and things will be better. I want to really dive into some of the good HSI has been doing. I read online, almost 100,000 pets in Ukraine will have received life-saving aid by the end of 2024, thanks to HSI and the Ukrainian Red Cross war response. First of all, how does this feel when you hear that?
Proud. Mm-hmm. Mm. So to give you a little bit of context, we started to work with the Red Cross in Ukraine in 2022, just a few months after the conflict in Ukraine started. And what we saw there was that millions of people had to flee from the areas that were impacted by the conflict, and many of these people lost their homes, but also lost their work, their income, their safe environment, friends, family around them. So the Red Cross then started to set up distribution points in the country where people could get basic humanitarian aid, like hygiene kits, like food, like blankets sometimes. And a large number of the people that went to these distribution points for help owned a companion animal that they were increasingly struggling to take care of, but did not want to abandon. So what we then did is Humane Society and Red Cross then started a nationwide pet care project, which has been growing rapidly because there is such a big demand. The number of districts in Ukraine where we run the pet care project has grown from 2 to 15 now. And what our aim is there is to keep the people and the pets united. Forced separation is not good for the animal, And it's not good for the people too. We know that research has been done that shows that worries about caring for one's pet significantly increases the stress during conflicts. And having to abandon your companion has a very negative impact on families, and in particular on children. Pets are family. They provide comfort and a sense of normality in times of crisis. So long answer, but short answer is, makes me feel very proud of what we are doing there. It helps. It really helps. It helps animals. It helps people too there.
It actually, you can see, it gives me really big chills when I started talking about this, because when I read that number, I thought, wow, it's just so amazing how much good you are doing and how many people and animals you can help, because you pointed out some of the big benefits. And I think it's so crucial when it comes to normality. I think this is a very, very, very big one, because when everything is stripped away, and you and I, we can't imagine how that is, but when everything is stripped away, like also when you have to flee, like it's your home, literally, like the country, the family, the neighbors, you never know, like when you have maybe little kids that are asking, mommy, when can we go back? You don't even have, even the answers are stripped away from you. And when you then have some sense of anchor, and I think that's something that we all need in times of crisis, is an anchor. In whatever we, you know, like have that anchor for, but pets are a very, very, very big anchor. And on an emotional, on a mental, on a physical level. And Martina also shared a beautiful story, how, you know, like with the animals and how much normality and also comfort it brings. So I can just imagine 100,000 pets. It is so much. And when I read that, I was thinking, wow, if I had to abandon my dog, it made me tear up. I was like, it's just heartbreaking. So to be able to probably almost help 100,000 people not to have to go through that, you can be really proud.
I'm so happy with what you just said, Sarah, because when we talk about refugees, then it's just a word. And sometimes we forget what it means. What it means to leave your home, leave everything behind, then all of a sudden from a steady life in a house with a job, with an income, you're torn away out of that. And you're arriving in an environment that you do not know, without anything. That it's so big for people. It's so incredibly impactful. And so sometimes I think that we forget that. We just talk about refugees and we have discussions about, of course, refugees coming into the country and all political. But imagine in a situation like in Ukraine, what that means for people when there's all of a sudden a war in your country. They didn't ask for it.
Yeah, it's important to put a face and a story to a word and to link them. Because even then we can't, you know, like grasp what they are really going through if we haven't been going through that. But I do think it builds bridges if we tie stories and faces to certain words.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what you also touched on is that sense of normality. We have seen so many people from Ukraine enter the European Union, and then at the border you saw those long queues of people wanting to cross the border into Poland or Romania. And then you saw the families, sometimes with two shopping bags, because that is all they could take. And then you see the children, and then with a small dog in their hands, and then for us, that's an additional argument to say, yeah, but we can't have a situation also for the refugees from Ukraine who entered the European Union, that they have to be separated, that they have to say, okay, no, we can't take care of this animal anymore.
Yeah, it's about come as you are, everyone is welcome. And in the end, yeah, that's also, if possible, that should be the goal when they bring their pet, that the pet is not less worthy of someone else. And I know to you and I, that's very normal. But I think it's important to know, like, even for people that might not see pets as family members, because maybe they don't have never yep. had pets, or, you know, yep. everyone has their yep. reasons.
Yeah.
Just to understand for them, it's the sister, it's the brother, it's the kid, you know, like
yep.
it's just, they have a different standing in their life. And I think that's the first step to acknowledge that the emotional bond is very different, because a pet is not a thing, it is a family member.
Exactly. And even for those families that where maybe not everyone is convinced of the pet being a family member, I would also say to them, once you adopt an animal, when an animal joins your, starts to live in your house and joins your family, you take on a responsibility for that animal. And that doesn't easily go away. You're really responsible, because what we have seen in Ukraine is that, despite all the efforts with the Red Cross and other things that we do, there have been animals that have been abandoned and landed on the streets. And for those animals in particular who have not grown up on the street, have grown up in a house, got food in the morning, got food in the evening, for these animals, it's really very, very difficult to survive, because it's they're not used to it. They are not used to the street life. So we were also working with a mobile veterinary clinic. So a small ambulance car with a vet driving it. He drives around in the conflict area or close to the conflict area and picks up animals that are really struggling, that are not or are injured, and he makes sure that they get the treatment that they need, and that they when they fully have recovered be adopted by a new family. So, but it's a war is the most terrifying, devastating thing that you can ever be in. So let's hope that it doesn't happen to us.
Mm. I'll definitely keep following your efforts, especially for the
Thank
Ukraine.
You.
It's you. Really it's yeah very heartwarming to know you make a big difference. And also I think it's not just to making the big difference to those particular pets and families, but also raising the awareness with everything you just said for people to maybe consider changing their perspective on certain things. And, you know, sometimes it just takes a little notch for people then to change their perspective.
Yes,
and that travels far.
Yes, and also, if I may add to that, the humanitarian organizations sometimes can. It would be good that they broaden their scope sometimes a bit too, because what I can tell you that at the beginning, when we started to talk about this with the Red Cross, there was some convincing to do. In the first, it didn't take very long, but they said, "Well, we're a humanitarian organization. We help people. We don't help animals. That's your job." So, then they started to see that the people who arrived at those distribution points, that they are struggling with caring for the animal, that they needed help on that. So, and then more and more questions came in, and then they said, "Okay, well, maybe Humane Society, we can work with you." And now it's exploding. It's growing so rapidly. This project, it's huge. It's growing because there's such a demand. So, but yeah, it's sometimes yeah. Broadening your view on things is something that the humanitarian organizations also could do.
They're invited to do that. it's a topic that we could talk for hours, but I want to make sure we also have time to talk about the other good you do, because I was also blown away when I read 25,000 animal trophies have been imported into the European Union from 2014 to 2022. Right. And can we please talk more about the import of hunting trophies? And you shared in a statement, you said the industry arguments that trophy hunting was essential for the conservation of species and that local communities benefited were absolutely wrong. Instead, it was often that healthy animals were taken out and that the main beneficiaries were foreign nationals, organizing trips, and local elites.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So let me start by saying something about what trophy hunting is exactly. And people may recall Cecil the Lion. 2015, the lion who was in Africa, who was killed by a recreational hunter from the US, who had bought a trip to Zimbabwe and had all the right permits to kill animals there, for entertainment. More recently, people may have seen the picture of a woman making a selfie in front of a giraffe that she had shot, posing with the heart of the animal that she had just cut out, and making a selfie like proud. It's an image that if you've seen it, you will never forget. Now, these are people who buy a trip to usually an African country to kill an animal and bring home body parts as a trophy. And those body parts, it can be a horn, it can be a tusk, it can be the manes, it can be a paw. Now, it's good to note that trophy hunting is not some far-off issue. It is way closer to home than most people can imagine. The EU is the second biggest actor in the import and export of animal trophies, just after the US, who's number one. Trophy hunting is a sport. It's a game. It's a competition. It is not an animal population management tool. So the goal is to get the largest horn, the largest tusk, the darkest mane, But those same physical traits are often indicators of the strength and the reproductive capacity of the animal. So trophy hunters do not hunt the weakest animals in a population, but they go for the strongest. So they hunt animals who are critical for the reproduction and to pass on survival knowledge to the younger generation. So this is why killing one animal can have a devastating consequence for the population, for biodiversity in that region. And also, there's a whole international industry, Sarah, organizing events, trips, competitions, an industry, I can tell you, making large profits out of this. So yes, in the EU, the total number of animal trophy imports was 25,000 over a 8-year period. This number includes the trophies from elephants, rhinos, polar bears, giraffes. So what Humane Society is trying to do in the European Union is to get bans in place on the import of these body parts. And Netherlands, Finland, Belgium recently have now introduced bans. So they're saying, no more animal trophies enter our country. And we hope that that other countries will follow.
Thank you very much for explaining also what animal trophy hunting is. What are some steps? Are there any steps that we as individuals can do? I'm aware, like, it needs to be from the government, like introducing those bans. So it's basically on a state level. But is there anything until then that we as individuals can do along the way?
So in the European Union, we are focusing on a number of countries, and of course the ultimate goal is that the legislators will introduce new legislation. But it always helps to influence politicians by making sure that they are aware what the population thinks and what the population wants them to do. So it always helps. So bring this in some form under the attention of politicians, legislators, is I think a very useful step. So I would keep an eye on the organizations also in the US who campaign on this. By the way, Humane Society is one of those organizations. So now and then organize petitions, etc. Participation in those is absolutely something that helps. It helps to influence politicians and to give them a push in the right direction.
I think an important point was also you shared it's much closer than we think. Because I'm sure if we'd ask now 10 people living in the US and the European Union, they would be like, oh, we are aware, but this is not happening in our country, you know, like that.
Or it's illegal.
Yeah,
many people think that it's illegal. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm very glad you pointed that out. And I think as with anything, if we raise awareness, and it starts from dinner parties we go to, sharing this podcast, writing a blog article about it, a social media, you know, it can be in small bits and pieces, but if we all help together, it's absolutely a big puzzle that can be seen then by the people that make legislation decisions.
Absolutely. All small steps help. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. I think one of the things that some people think, oh, this is too small to make a difference. And I always say, we don't know the bigger picture. And that small piece might be the seed for that entire, you know, woods that's going to grow and help. So I think never be afraid to take a step, no matter how small it might look, because it could really have a big ripple effect. Might not be in this year or in 5 years or 10 years, but it might be in 25 years that this is going to be the big change because of your little seed.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Ruud, when I read your background, I also found something very interesting. It's because you're not just doing good at your work, but also in your personal life. And you volunteered with an animal ambulance service. I am wondering how, like, give me all the details. How was that? And how did it make you feel? And maybe also, what are some lessons that you have learned throughout that time? Because I remember on New Year's Day, a lady had a little accident, but we were like in the middle of the woods, so we had to call, you know, 911, and they had a dog. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, thank God the dog is fine, because in all honesty, I wouldn't know who to call right away, like out, right, you know. Right. Obviously, afterwards, I Googled and saved the number, but I was like, I actually have no idea how an animal ambulance service works, because so far, whenever our family dog had something, we went to the next clinic, you know, like that's, and we drove ourselves. So how does an animal ambulance service work?
Right. So, in the Netherlands, there are many animal ambulance service providers. Hundreds. I think that the coverage is, it's a small country, so it's relatively easy. The coverage is nationwide. So I think every location in the Netherlands, where you are, when you see an animal that, and that can be a bird, that can be a squirrel, that can be a dog that got lost, a cat that got injured in an accident, you call the number, and the animal ambulance arrives and brings the animal to the closest veterinarian. And even if that means that the life of that animal is being ended there, then at least the suffering will also end, and the animal will not stay on the street and then have some really miserable last couple of hours or even days. Now, on your other question on life lessons, right? So, I love that question, and let me tell you the story of a cat, Luca. I was driving the animal ambulance, and we got a call that a kitten. Was attacked by a dog, and the owner called the animal ambulance because the owner could not drive to the vet himself. So I got there, and there I saw Luca. Luca sat on the couch, and what had happened was that Luca was small, was a kitten, and he got attacked by a bigger dog, and the dog had taken the whole head of Luca in his mouth and bit. One of Luca's eyes had popped out. His jaw was completely damaged, broken. But he was still conscious. And he was sitting there, and it was it breaks your heart, that kind of images. But anyhow, so I brought him to the veterinarian, that was closest by. And the veterinarian said, well, yeah, you know, I need to remove that eye. I cannot save that. The jaw needs surgery. I need to x-ray the skull to see if there are any damages there. So I'm going to call the owner because, yeah, it needs to be paid. So I was sitting there in the treatment room with waiting for him to come back with Luca, and Luca was still conscious, and still he was so disarming, so still friendly, because many animals, when they get injured, they get into the protection and sometimes attack, but he did the opposite. So then the veterinarian came back. And he said, well, the owner is not going to pay for all those things, unfortunately. So I have to put Luca to sleep. Sorry, but I'm not going to pay for it either. So then, because in those hours, I had gotten into some connection with Luca. So I said, no, I'm going to pay for it. So if you think that he has a chance of having a good life, then please treat him. And so that same evening, the eye was removed. The next morning, the jaw got surgery. A week later, another surgery. The skull was all fine. So there was the veterinarian was saying, well, this cat can lead a good life. He can cope with having one eye. That's not a problem. You can guess what happened then. I adopted Luca a few months later after he recovered, and he died last year. But after 14 years, he living with us, and I can tell you that he was one of the most happy-go-lucky animals that I've ever met. So everyone in the street knew Luca, and they called him the little pirate because he had only one eye. And Luca got along with our dogs very well. He always joined me the evening walks when I walked the dogs. He walked with us. And then I had to cross a busy street. And so I told him always to wait because that was dangerous. I crossed the street with the dogs. He waited in the garden until we returned half an hour, 45 minutes later. And there he was waiting for us. And he joined us again and walked back home. And so such a happy, uncomplicated life that he led with an open mind, and despite his traumas. And he also managed to live together with our dogs, despite the fact that another dog had done so much damage to him, which I think if it's one life lesson, then this was, I keep on thinking of him, maybe not every day, but very often, about how he did that, how he managed that to despite all the suffering and the traumas, have that wonderful life.
You're probably so, it made me tear up. It's such a heartwarming, like from a heartbreaking to a heartwarming story. It's, I think one of the biggest lessons for myself as well, what we can learn from animals, how they bounce back from trauma, whatever the trauma looked like. But if we give them the opportunity and the time and the space, they open their heart again and they open their mind again and they fully embrace life. And I think that's something as humans, if we can just like get a little bit more of that, I think our life would be so much better.
Yes.
Rude.
But there are differences in animals too, of course. I think some bounce back easier than others, but I'm completely with you if you say, okay, well, us humans, if we can have a little bit more of that, a little bit more capacity to do that, then yes, absolutely, it would be very helpful and wonderful.
I would love to follow up on that. You know, during the last decades, a lot of new scientific insights regarding animals have been obtained. And I think it's a great follow-up because most scientists now agree that several animal species can experience emotions. What are your thoughts on this progress? And I'm also curious, how do the scientific or how does this scientific evidence impact laws, if it impacts laws?
So yes, absolutely, there's so much happening, and I cannot tell you how happy this move, these new insights makes me. I think our Western culture in particular is inclined to focus on the differences between humans and non-human animals. It was the 17th century philosopher René Descartes, a French philosopher, who stated that animals are like machines. So and they act following their instincts. And I can tell you from my own personal experience, when I was about 10 years old, I went to school, and there the teachers they told me that humans are very special because they can think, they can feel, they can reason, they can etc. And animals are following their instincts and not much more than that. And so what those teachers back then did is to send a message. Humans are special and unique, and we put ourselves a bit on a pedestal. Now, over time, I think that science has taught us and is still teaching us that we are not that unique at all. For example, if you look at the use of tools, for a long time, we thought that we were the only ones, the only species that used tools. But then we saw chimpanzees use sticks to extract ants from anthills. We saw big apes use leaves as umbrellas. We saw sea otters use stones to crack open shells. So that was not it that made us so unique. So we thought of something else. We said, okay, well, but we humans, we are the only species with really advanced communications. But then we discovered that some animal species have very, very advanced communications, communication mechanisms as well. And then we thought of something else, cultures. Humans were the only one who had cultures in groups. And then we found that some bird species have regional dialects in their songs, that elephants have mourning rituals that differ from group to group. So yes, and this applies to emotions as well. So for a long time we have thought that we were the only ones. My conclusion is that although there certainly are many differences between different species, we are not that special as we used to think. We may be unique, but so are other animal species, all animal species, they are all unique. It is certainly not justified to think that we are the only ones that can think and feel.
And how does the scientific evidence impact certain laws when it comes to animals and their protection?
I think there's a growing number of countries that are now seeing animals as sentient beings. For example, the European Union has in its Lisbon Treaty explicitly stated that animals are sentient beings. A growing number of people are saying animals have a consciousness, have an intrinsic value. And that once that lands in legislation, it changes things. It does not immediately result in, okay, well, those animals have a consciousness and they feel, so we cannot hurt them, we cannot do anything with them. But the fact that the intrinsic value is now being included in a lot of the country laws in the European Union really helps, because it adds something. It says something about the value that an animal has, which is not financial or emotional for humans. The animal has a value on itself. So, may I share a quick example on
everything? I was just about to ask if we could talk more about the intrinsic value of animals, and like if you have more examples, and also if it's limited to certain species or if all animals
Right. So intrinsic value is not something that is part of an object or part of a living being. It is something that we people assign to it, that we give to it. It's a value that we give to something. So it will depend on who you ask. There are cultures that say, well, plants have an intrinsic value. Stones have an intrinsic value. Rivers have an intrinsic value. So, the important element here is that once we start to recognize that value, it changes things. That example that I wanted to share, it's about something that happened a while ago in the town where I lived. A couple got into a fight. Now the man got so angry at the woman that he threw the dog and the cat that he had once given to her as presents. He threw them out of the window, fifth floor, so both the dog and the cat did not survive. So the woman then went to the police to report the animal cruelty that happened here. Now the police then said, well, because the animals are dead, this is not a case of animal cruelty, but because the animals were your property, you can, if you hand over the purchase receipts of the animals, you can argue that your property has been damaged, and then the man would have to pay. So this is a typical example of our society not acknowledging the intrinsic value of an animal. It did not matter that the animals were killed. The only thing that counted was the financial value of the animal. So this example, Sarah, was years ago, and things have changed, and they are still changing. And I believe it's definitely a big step forward that more and more countries are now acknowledging the intrinsic value of animals. But it depends on the situation. To what extent that really counts, and even within a certain species. So if you look at, for example, if you look at rats. Rats can be seen as a pest, And then almost everything is allowed. But rats are being used in laboratories as well for tests. Then there are strict rules. Rats can be a companion animal for people too. And then a different set of rules applies. Now, I sometimes think that our culture has a tendency to undermine the idea of animals having an intrinsic value. In particular, farm animals. We do not like the thought that they have an intrinsic value. So, and the example that I can give on that is if you may have seen the videos on YouTube where children are being told that the meat that they're eating actually is part of an animal's body. And when they hear that for the first time, so those what you see then is that the children get really upset. They start crying. They say, I don't want to eat this anymore. And I think that has to do with the fact that many children naturally relate with animals. They see them as living beings that have a right to exist, to live, and who should not be hurt. So the initial response of children many times is, I don't want to eat that. Now, ask adults to reflect on the meat that is on their plate, and you will get a very different response. A response in which the fact that the farm animal had a right to exist and should not be hurt is not being seen as so important anymore, and sometimes even completely ignored. So something is happening with us between childhood and adulthood, and in particular in this area, I think.
It's something that Martina and I also talked about in our episode, just a tiny bit, where she said it's important to teach kids from an early age on that a pig and a cow is as important as a dog and a cat. And I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on why our association with farm animals or the importance we give to them often changes throughout our adulthood?
I think there are huge interests here from a lot of people. So in making sure that for example, if you the coverage the footage of animals living in a farm, in particular in industrialized farming systems, they're pretty rare. They usually come from organizations who do some undercover work, etc., etc. So we like to close that. We like to put that we like to put that in a box in our brain and maybe even ignore that it's there. Because there is, as we all know, there's a lot of suffering there from animals. So and then of course there's an interest of people making money out of that, and it's a lot of people. It's not just farmers and producers, but also retail and so on. So there's a lot at stake. I hope that the world eventually will move towards not eating meat anymore. But at the same time, that being said, it's so huge, it's so big. Still, it will not happen overnight. It will take time. Personally, I really hope that will happen at some point in time. But I think that is a bit of an explanation why we don't like to look at that with regard to farm animals. So it's on the happy squirrel in the forest, or that's a bit of a different story, or the deer, or whatever. Then we say, yeah, that animal, you shouldn't hurt it. But on farm animals, it's a bit of a different category for us.
Ruud, what do you think when it comes to intrinsic values of animals, like all animals? The advancements in technology, especially with AI, can we benefit from that? Could that help for intrinsic value of animals be more worldwide accepted? Could that be a push?
I think so. So we know that there are, at the moment, while we speak, there are people developing apps that you can put on your mobile phone, and then you point the camera of your mobile phone in the direction of your dog, and the app will tell you what the dog is communicating at that moment. Which is using AI technology, which is fascinating, because we read books on what it means when the ears of your dogs are down or up, when the lip is being raised a little bit, when the hairs on the back stand up. When the tail goes a little bit to the left or up, but we don't speak dog. For us, it's very difficult to get all those signals and process it and then turn it in something that makes sense for us. So these apps will for sure help us to communicate with animals, to see what they are trying to say, what they're trying to express. Because I believe they're working on apps for dogs at the moment in particular. But if that time will come, if we can do something similar for cows or chickens or pigs, imagine what that would do, that we see with a video what that pig in that farm, how that animal feels, what it's trying to communicate. That would be a big shift. I sincerely hope, because then it's on that same track as we were talking about before. We come from a situation where we saw animals as machines. It's very hard to care about a machine, but once you start to see that animal thinks and feels and expresses itself and wants to communicate, then things start to change. When you start to see that pigs are very playful animals, they like to play. But even some recent research, bees that in a box and you give them very small wooden balls, they start to play with the balls, and there's no reward for them, but they start to play, and you see that they're having fun, that they're enjoying themselves. So imagine what AI could do there to create more for us, more insight into the world of the animals' cognitions and emotions. I think that would be another step in the right direction and would make it for us more natural to see them as living beings that want to live, that deserve a good life, that we should not hurt.
I'm so excited about this AI progress. I honestly didn't know about it. And I was just imagining, wow, and then we have this app and how amazing it will be, not just with our own pets, but like, you know, like when we are in the woods and we see, an animal that stays quiet for a second and we like use the camera and then we, you know, it's just because otherwise it's always our own interpretation. And then actually getting a real feedback is just, it's just amazing. And you brought up a lot of the emotions and also the playfulness. In what ways do animals' emotion parallel and also differ from our own emotions, so from human emotions? And is there anything we can learn from the similarities and also differences?
Right. I think that we have learned from numerous scientific studies that there are more similarities than differences, if there are differences at all. Charles Darwin already wrote about the evolution of mental characteristics. So many people think that he only wrote about the evolution of physical traits, but he spent most of his time actually on studying mental aspects. So Darwin argued that emotions have evolved over time because they are beneficial to individuals living and doing things together. So we know now that the bees like to play, but we also know, for example, the res fish. When you give them a mirror, the first time they see themselves in the mirror, they act aggressively because the first time they think, oh, there's another fish, and I need to be careful. But then they start to relax. Then they start to swim in unusual movements, upside down, etc. And then they're studying what is happening there. So experimenters have added a little dot of paint on the body of the res fish. And then once the res fish spots that dot in the mirror, then he thinks, oh, I need to, and he starts to try to rub it off and clean. So what I'm trying to say is that animal consciousness, including animal emotions, is much more a rule than an exception. And what is interesting, by the way, is the recent signing of the New York Declaration on Animal Consciousness. It was signed on mid-April this year, by many, many scientists. And bottom line in that declaration is that scientific research has shown us that not only humans have a consciousness, or just mammals, but also birds, reptiles, fishes, octopus, insects. And I believe that there is much more research to be done. But I personally think that we will find evidence that animals can also experience emotions like love, like happiness, like loneliness, like anxiety, empathy. We will see that. So I'm not sure if we will find many, many differences. I think it's all gradual steps, and we're not that different. So.
Mm-hmm. And regardless of all the scientific evidence, I think, mm-hmm. if we put that aside, just, and you have animals at home, I think they just show, you know, like they experience fear. They also experience like empathy when we are not feeling well. They, even if we don't cry and don't like physically show it, they sometimes they even know it before we know it. So I think it's just that these are all indicators that animals have that big empathy. Probably sometimes more than us humans.
Yes, so I We have a dog and two cats in our home, there's absolutely a lot that I learned from them, I think they're all rescues and have had some bad experience with humans in the past, and I'm so happy and grateful that they opened up for us, even when they had those bad experiences in the past. Some sooner than others, but they all eventually did. And yes, there are many things that I also so learned from them, sometimes being patient, or but there's another example. We had a dog. He passed away too, who was very very self-confident, very not aggressive, but very relaxed, powerful. So when he stepped into the park and met other dogs, his whole posture was like, "Here I am, here I am." And then everyone came sniffing, and "Oh, who are you? Who are you?" And all good, all friendly. That kind of thing too, right? So so postures and how you act and how you act towards in the direction of other people, it has an impact on the other side, and you will get a response on that. So it's also little things. So there was a friend here a couple of weeks ago, and he was walking. He was telling me that he always checked Facebook and Instagram, and while he was walking the dog, and I said, "Stop doing that. Stop. Try it a couple of times, and just observe. Just look at your companion, and there are so many things that you can learn."
I love that you brought up being more present with them, rather than being always on the phone and listening to podcasts and multitasking, because it also allows us to have a deeper relationship with them, but not just with them, but also with ourselves, because they can teach us so much. And as you know, I wrap up every episode with an animal Q&A, and you've mentioned you have multiple pets at home, but I would love to dedicate it to your kitten, Luca. What is
Thank
one
you.
reason you are grateful for, Luca? One of the many.
Luca has played an important part of in my life. He has been with us for a long time, for 14 years. He as I said, he was the most happy-go-lucky animal, despite everything that had happened in his past. And that is something that keeps on inspiring me. I'm really happy that he came into our lives, and that he decided to spend his life with us.
I'm sure he's happy too. If you could ask him one question, what would it be?
Sarah, I lost you now.
Oh, if you could ask him one question, what would it be?
I would probably ask him something like, did you have a good life with us? Did you I'm assuming, because he showed that he enjoyed things that he enjoyed being with us. There's always something, because communications with an animal, it it has its limitations. So I would probably ask him that. So what did you think of your life? Are you happy with it? Are you happy that you stayed with us? The other animals, I would ask maybe some different questions. So our the dog that we have now, I would, he's getting old. I would probably ask him something like, are you okay? Are you not in pain? And please don't hide it from us if that ever happens, because it's bound to happen. And we also have two kittens. Who would probably ask something like, could you please stop ruining our plants? Because that's the latest thing that they are working on.
That is so funny. And on this happy note, Ruud, I want to thank you so much for your time. I'm so moved by our interview, what you shared, like from your personal life, how Luca found you and how you got rewarded for really stepping in and stepping up in that moment, for all the good you're doing in your personal and your professional life. I'm just, yeah, my heart feels very warm. And it's so good to know that there are people out there like you that make a big difference for all of us.
Thank you very much, Sarah. It was wonderful to talk with you today. Yes, I'm glad that we had this conversation. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a wrap for today, everyone. If you loved the episode as much as we did, please share it with your family and friends to inspire them to do more good in the world. And we see you back next Wednesday.